Hello, everybody. This is Keith Pannell. Welcome back to Science Studio. We've got an interesting program today because there's a celestial event that's going to happen on November the 11th. And that's a day, of course, that we remember as Veterans Day and the armistice of World War I. But it turns out that on that particular day this year, in our particular part of the world, we should be able to see something very rare. And that is the passage or the transit of Mercury across the face of the sun. Now, of course, you need special equipment to look for it, but we're going to have a program then talking about this transit and helio astronomy and all sorts of wonderful things. And unusual for this program, we've got two guests in separate studios about 1,000 miles apart. One is an expert on the whole concept of planetary science. Her name is Renee Weber and works for NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, and she works at the Marshall Space Center over in Huntsville, Alabama, and she's a planetary scientist, and in particular, she is the director of an organization there called Heliophysics and Planetary Science. Quite a title. So anyway, Renee over there in the east of El Paso, welcome to Science Studio.
Hello.
And right in the studio here is somebody that is completely a stranger to science in many ways, but happens to have a tremendous hobby in studying celestial events. His name is Andrew Fleck, Professor Andy Fleck, from the Department of English, and he's a specialist in, of all things, Shakespeare. Now, you're going to find out how on earth these two disparate folks come together with me in a studio or by the magic of radio to talk about a celestial event. So where should we start? I think, Renee, you're the expert on this, so we'll start with you, and let's learn a little bit about how Renee, from being a young girl to now a professional scientist, what was that journey like? What made you sort of choose this as a career path?
Well, I suppose I've always been interested in science and astronomy. And, you know, as a kid, very, very into science fiction. And, of course, a lot of movies and TV shows that sort of spurred me towards things science-related. But I didn't formally decide to become a scientist as a profession until I went to graduate school. And I had been pursuing as an undergraduate physics major different areas within physics. I did a little bit of solid-state physics and material science. I did a little bit of high-pressure physics. I did a little bit of astrophysics, and finally I settled on a focus in geophysics, and that's ultimately what I ended up going to graduate school for.
Okay, but I mean, when you were 6, 7, you said you liked science fiction, or 16, whatever age. Can you tell us some of the authors that you read? What was a particularly memorable piece of literature on science fiction?
Well, it wasn't so much reading as it was watching TV and movies.
Ah, okay.
I did get into reading science fiction, but that wasn't until much later. But definitely as a kid, I was watching Star Trek, Star Wars, mostly Star Trek and Star Wars. So you can thank that.
Okay, fine. So anyway, so physics was the first thing that you studied. What did you study?
I studied undergraduate at the University of California in Berkeley.
That's a good school.
And I went to graduate school at the University of California in San Diego.
All right. So you're a California girl.
Yes, although I am originally from the state of New York.
Okay, so then that puts you in perspective. Very much the scientist interested in science fiction, at least TV, etc., and movies from an early age. Let's just chat here for a few minutes with Andrew. Andrew Fleck, Professor of English, specializing in Shakespeare and other authors of that ilk, in that period of time anyway. How on earth do we sit in this studio together to talk about a planetary event?
Well, for me, it all started, I was interested in a play, not by Shakespeare, but by one of his contemporaries. And in it, the tragic character refers to a comet. And I thought, huh. I mean, just sort of got glossed away in the edition that I was using. I thought, I wonder what's going on with this comet. So basically sort of following that comet in a lot of different kind of ways in which it shows up, I got interested in early modern astronomy. And so I've been doing a little bit of work on the connection between literature and early modern astronomy.
That's actually very interesting. So what comet was it? What was the year? And have you followed it as it returns to Earth every cycle?
So the comet came up in 1618. 1618 is a sort of a rare year in that there were three comets that year. These are the first comets that were observed telescopically. And so the third one was the one that sort of caught everyone's attention as, gosh, there must be something significant happening for there to be three in one year. And there was an English astronomer, a guy named Sir John Bainbridge, who wrote a book, published, this is the only printed book in English about the comet in 1618. And the thing that really struck me as odd about that book is that it basically divides into two halves. And so on the first half of it, you have Bainbridge describing empirically what he could see, although he didn't use a telescope. He used something called a Jacob's staff, which is an older technology, and said, on this day, the comet was in this place, and on this day, the comet was in this place. then he tries to calculate the distance to the comet, and it's actually a kind of a funny moment, or I think it's a kind of a funny moment. He says, now I'm going to tell you the distance. He says, you're not going to believe me. It's very far away. Hold on to your seats. Okay. The number is. Then he gives this number.
Quite a showman.
Yeah.
All right.
And he basically says, it's so far beyond the moon, you're not going to believe it. And the thing about comets is that until that time, there was at least some, the prevailing belief was that a comet was just an exhalation of the atmosphere that caught fire, and that it was definitely below the moon. And so for it to be as far away as Bainbridge was predicting, and he was not alone in this, but he was writing for an English audience and writing in English, which is actually another interesting facet of this. Of course, the comet goes through the constellation Libra, which is the scales of justice. And so, you know, we have these problems going on in the country. So then he goes into this whole thing about how the comet is reflecting on, you know, this injustice and that problem and this issue. And, you know, it happens to coincide with the execution of a really famous explorer, Sir Walter Raleigh. So this is just, you know, obviously the king is, you know, doing the right kind of thing. And I mean, it's just a very strange sort of thing for these two things to sit next to each other in the same moment. I don't know.
That distinguishes you from a sort of a scientific nerd. Do you ever get this fascinated by comets and celestial bodies, Renee?
Oh, certainly. I in fact, remember as a kid, with some friends sleeping out on my friend's trampoline in her yard so that we could watch, I believe it was Hale-Bopp Comet.
Oh, yes.
Flying when I was in high school. And I actually just got a telescope for Christmas recently, and I take that out every once in a while. I like to look at the moon and the planets. And there was a comet recently that I did my very first ever comet photography.
Oh, I didn't
which
know
was Comet 46P, and it was pretty cool because it looked green in the sky. So definitely looked at a lot of those. And I do also remember as a kid, Halley's Comet. If I'm lucky, I'll live to see again.
Exactly.
Oh, when is it due next?
Oh, geez,
another
60-something
years.
60?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, good luck. you know, you mentioned Hale-Bopp. Alan Hale has been a guest on this program many times. He just lives about 100 miles up in the mountains in New Mexico, and he's a very interesting fellow. Basically, he was an out-of-work astronomer, all right? He's got a PhD in astronomy, and just one night saw this and immediately twigged his intellectual interest and sent off the observation, and then had to wait to find out if anybody else was going to see it. And a few hours later, somebody in Arizona, Bob, he saw it too, and so hence Hale-Bopp. But Alan made a bit of a name for himself because he started writing books about comets during the period when Hale-Bopp was on everybody's tongue. So it's just fascinating. Okay, so now let's go back to Rene a little bit. I introduced you saying you were an expert in heliophysics.
Actually, planetary science.
Or planetary science and heliophysics, or...
So I manage the group that also consists of heliophysicists.
Okay, well, tell us a little bit. I think we can get a little bit of idea about what planetary science is. You know, you're looking at planets, you want to find out what they're made of, and do they have cores, etc. But heliophysics, this is physics of the sun. Is there something really very different about physics in the sun's environment than, say, here on Earth?
Yeah, so of course there are differences in that. You know, the sun is a star as opposed to a planet, and it's consisting mostly of hot ionized gases instead of solid rocks. And a lot of the folks in the heliophysics group here are investigating the process of coronal heating, so understanding energy transfer in the sun's atmosphere. And like I mentioned, they often are developing special instruments to observe the sun, not from the ground, but actually from orbit or from a sounding rocket, which is suborbital, and can benefit from not having to see through the Earth's atmosphere, so to speak. So, you know, if you go out into space where you're above the atmosphere of the Earth, you can take clearer pictures of the sun that aren't as contaminated by the effects of light traveling through the atmosphere.
If I could interject, though, that's also much less romantic, because out there the stars won't twinkle, presumably, anyway.
Because they don't have atmospheric interference.
Yeah. There's no thermal gradients to go through, and so in a sense it's rather boring. But nevertheless, carry on, sorry.
So as far as transits are concerned, transits are historically how scientists shifted from thinking of the Earth at the center of the solar system to thinking about the sun at the center of the solar system. And that was, of course, a big revolution in science in general. And so today, you know, a lot of the helio folks do actually observe the sun with telescopes from the ground. And you do need special equipment to point a telescope at the sun, most notably a solar filter that will filter out all of the harmful rays that could actually damage your eyes. And in so doing, you can observe the sun's surface, and you can see sunspots. And if you're lucky, you can see solar prominences, or you can see transits where the planets that are between us and the sun, so Mercury and Venus, actually cross the disk. And that happens because of the alignment of the planets in their orbits. So the orbit of the Earth around the sun is called the ecliptic, and if you think of that orbit as existing in a flat plane, you can then reference the orbits of all of the other planets with respect to that plane. And as it turns out, most planets orbit within approximately the same plane as the ecliptic. Not exactly, you know, they're all somewhat inclined with respect to the ecliptic, but it's all pretty close. And so as a result, every so often, those planets sort of eclipse the sun the same way the moon eclipses the sun, except, you know, because they're much, much farther away, they don't actually block. You wouldn't be able to look at the sun and notice it actually getting dimmer with your eye. But if you were looking at it through a special solar filter, you can actually see that little black dot, which is the planet crossing the face of the sun.
And that's what we're going to be able to observe on the 11th of November.
That is correct.
And so we've set the program up now. We'll be back in one moment. We're going to take a short break. This is Keith Pannell in El Paso, Texas, with Andrew Fleck, talking to Rene Weber over in Huntsville, or at least very close to Huntsville, Alabama, a NASA representative, and we'll be back in one moment. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Professor Andrew Fleck from the Department of English at the University of Texas at El Paso, and Rene Weber from the NASA organization over there in Huntsville, Alabama. We're talking about what's going to happen on November the 11th when this little tiny planet, Mercury, has the audacity to sort of draw attention to itself by crossing the face of the sun, such that with the particular equipment, we should be able to see this little dot traversing. A couple of questions here, Rene, then. First of all, how long does it take to traverse and transit from one side to the other?
Oh, I think just under 6 hours from start to finish.
Okay, so there's plenty of time to see it.
Yes.
And secondly, it can be seen anywhere in the world where the sun is observable?
There are maps where you can go online and put in where you are, and it'll tell you. Obviously, the sun has to be up during the appropriate time, and the start and stop times will depend on your geographical location on the surface of the Earth.
Right.
But it should be visible across North America And the times will vary, of course, depending on location and time zone. But it'll be during the day, obviously.
Right. So then, having said that, anybody in North America and South America, presumably, and anywhere where the sun's up, you stand a good chance of having a period of time when you can see this. Won't necessarily be 6 hours, but whatever. What is a good astronomer like yourself, or a good planetary scientist like yourself, Renee, going to be looking for, if indeed you're going to be looking? That would be a terrible secret if you're busy in meetings all day. So I assume you're going to take time out to have a look. What would you be looking for other than just the historic presence?
Well, fortunately, it is a holiday, so as long as it's sunny, I will be out looking. And I think the times that are most interesting are usually considered the very beginning and the very end of the transit, where you first see Mercury start to cross the disk of the sun, and then, you know, of course, it'll go across, and then you'll see it leave. And just looking at it, it moves pretty slowly, so I don't think while you're looking at it, you can actually kind of notice it moving. But definitely, if you're monitoring it over the course of the full transit, then you'll see it actually cross the disk.
Because one moment there's nothing, and then one moment there is something.
And yeah. And as it turns out, like I mentioned earlier, the transit, you can think of the transit as a sort of eclipse. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily eclipse as in it blocks all the light, but it does actually block some of the light. And while it might not be noticeable to the human eye, if you were using instruments to monitor the, you know, total flux of light coming out of the sun during a transit, you would notice that it drops. And that is actually the method that we use to detect exoplanets. So planets that are orbiting distant stars, the same sort of alignment between the sun, Mercury, and Earth occurs between Earth, the distant star, and an exoplanet orbiting that distant star. And if you were constantly monitoring the brightness of a distant star and you noticed that it every so often appeared to slightly dip, that is, as it turns out, because there is an exoplanet transiting that star. And that is how we detect exoplanets, and that is how our understanding of, you know, our solar system as being this unique thing has actually shifted from, you know, we didn't really know that other planets existed to now we think most stars probably have planets orbiting them.
They seem to crop up like mushrooms, in fact. We've done many programs on exoplanets and even exoplanetary climate and weather patterns, if you can believe it. Well, Andy, same question. What are you going to do on the 11th of November?
Well, I'm going to be here on campus with a couple of my colleagues in the physics department, and we'll look at the transit. Veterans Day, unfortunately, is not a day off for us here, so we'll all be teaching. So a lot of us will be on campus anyway, and we hope that students will come out too, and you'll get a chance to watch the transit through some of our really nice telescopes on campus here.
And at what time does the transit begin here? Is it so the transit an early morning operation?
Yeah, so unfortunately, unlike Renee or Dr. Weber, we won't be able to see Mercury come into the disk of the sun. It'll, by the time the sun comes up here, it will already the transit will already be in progress. But we can watch it exit the sun if people are interested in sticking around for the last part of it. And, of course, the other complicating factor for us on campus is that there are mountains off to our east. So we have to wait for the sun to get above those mountains, too.
Yeah, well, that's true. But so what time would the exit be, if you like?
I believe the exit's going to be right around noon.
Okay.
Maybe so a little bit later than that.
Plenty of time to to see that.
So students who happen to be on campus on the, you know, for morning classes, if they want to stop by, we'll have the location up, but you'll be able to come in and you know, we'll have the right filters. And I think actually my colleague Dr. Noriega is going to project it so that you don't have to worry about the filters. If you project, and this is of course historically how the first transit was observed, but if you project the image onto a screen, you can watch the
dot.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
Move across.
Yeah.
So, going back to literature, are you interested, or are you familiar with the literature that is written literature by non-scientists?
Yeah.
about Mercury? Is there much of a literature out there?
There isn't as much as you might expect. I mean, so the period that I study, the Renaissance, there's a transition happening there between a kind of an older notion of the universe and how we exist in it, and the beginnings of what we think of as a not necessarily a specially designated corner of the universe or the cosmos kind of thing. So in the older period, celestial bodies were thought to have impacts on every part of your life, including your health. And so Mercury is a friend of mine was using the term influencer this morning. It's an influencer in the sense that it, you know, it affects, I believe it was, I think it was something like it affects your respiration or something like that. And so, you know, it can have an impact on, you know, whether you feel short of breath or that kind of thing. Anyway, you'll see references to Mercury and the planets and so on in ways that you just sort of, today we just sort of dismiss as, oh, you know, that's just an outmoded way of thinking about things.
Well, just to remind the audience, I mean, I think it was the Romans who named it Mercury. Mm-hmm. Just tell us why they thought Mercury was an appropriate name for this planet.
Ah, well, I mean, I think that they thought that it was it's the fastest planet, right? It moves really quickly, and Mercury was the messenger of the gods who moved very quickly, and so I think that's why they associated this very fast planet. I mean, it's got the shortest orbit in the in our solar system, and so it moves very quickly. And I think that they thought that he's like Mercury.
Interesting feature there. I mean, how did Mercury, the god, move? Did he have wings on his feet?
He was represented as having winged feet. Yeah, Hermes is the Greek version, right?
So back over to René over there in the east. What are the big questions that one has these days about the sun?
About the sun? Hmm. Well,
I mean, you're directing this heliophysics group, and although that's not your particular focus, the sun is an important feature to climate. And I don't know if you want to get into climate change or climate variations. And, you know, some people say that these variations are simply historic because the sun fluctuates in the amount of energy it sends out and we receive. Would you like to talk to that a little bit?
Well, the sun does have an activity cycle. And I do believe that we are close to the minimum in that cycle right now. It's an 11-year cycle.
That's the sunspot cycle.
That's the sunspot cycle, yes. And our group of heliophysicists here tend to like to launch their missions more in the active part of the sunspot cycle because the processes that drive solar coronal heating are easier to understand when there are active regions to image. And so they like to have an active sun and not what we call a quiet sun, which is if you were to look at the sun right now, you would see a quiet sun. Hmm. And the questions that they're interested in answering are related to this issue of coronal heating. So if you were to sort of measure the temperature of the sun's corona, which is the outer atmosphere of the sun, it's very hot, and that's sort of the opposite of what you would expect, where, you know, the temperature would sort of decrease the further you get from the sun's sort of fusion core. Like, exactly why that is the case and what the mechanisms are that create those conditions, that is one of the topics that the Helio group here at Marshall is interested in trying to explore.
I remember just a few years ago, there was some concern amongst scientists that studied the sun that the arrival of the sunspots was sort of delayed by a little. Am I correct in thinking that? Well, I know I read about it, that up here in Sunspot Observatory, there was a lag in this 11-year cycle. I don't know if that ever got explained.
Yeah, I'm not sure how perfect or how regular of a cycle it is. I think it might be sort of, on average, over many, many cycles, it's about this much. But, of course, everyone is different. Every cycle is different.
Well, every science studio is the same. We have 28 minutes, and our allotted 28 minutes has been taken up. So René Weber over there at Huntsville, Alabama, at the NASA Marshall Flight Center, thank you very much for being here and sharing your expertise on planetary science and the sun. And Andrew Fleck, right here in the University of Texas at El Paso, keep reading that old literature and try it. We should do a collaboration. I'm now intrigued in how often that particular Bainbridge comet has returned. And can we find some history there? Anyway, Renee, thank you very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And Andy, thank you very much for being in the studio.
Thanks, Keith.
Sam, thank you very much for putting the program together. And finally, the audience, thank you for being there. We'll be back next week with another, goodness knows what it'll be about, but it won't be about Mercury. Take care. Bye-bye.